We've long heard about an apple a day keeping the doctor away, but there are lots of other ways that food can serve as medicine. Also, how youth activism around the Parkland, Florida shooting is further energizing one organization that wants to extend the right to vote to 16 and 17-year-olds. We also speak with an Illinois vet about his work to save more than 10,000 critically endangered tortoises in Madagascar. And you may have heard of a little musical called Hamilton. This fall, Lin-Manuel Miranda is opening a brand new exhibition in Chicago that focuses on the history of the real-life Alexander Hamilton. Here's Chicago Tribune theater critic Chris Jones.
What they're going to be able to do that no other museum has really been able to do is integrate sort of an exhibition on American history with the biggest hit show of the, you know, last 100 years.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With all the attention we pay to healthcare dollars in our own healthcare, how much do we think about what we eat? Well, the idea of food and medicine isn't new. It's as old as medicine itself. But what does that really mean? That's being explored at a symposium that's taking place this weekend at the Chicago Botanic Garden. It's being sponsored by North Shore Health System, one of its integrative family doctors, Dr. Geeta Maker-Clark. Dr. Geeta Maker-Clark is on the line with us from Evanston now. She's also the coordinator of integrative medical education at the University of Chicago. Dr. Maker-Clark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this whole concept of food as medicine is something that's really an old idea, but maybe I think we should start by just telling, if you can just explain what that means.
This is a really ancient concept. The very beginnings of what we now consider medicine really came from this idea that diet and nutrition were the most important medicines that one could take. And of course, this was before we had pharmaceuticals, right? We were just using food and plants and community-based healers to help bring us into better states of health. So this concept of food as medicine now that's enjoying a resurgence is really, in my opinion, an opportunity for us to go back to our roots in medicine and sort of say, hey, before we think about a pharmaceutical drug to cure us of our ailment, let's look at our lifestyle, let's look at what we're eating and start from there.
So with that idea in mind, when you think about the way that we are eating in a modern American context, what do you think we've lost?
That is a great question. This is something that I've thought a lot about, and I feel that at some point, especially in America, it was the industrialization of food, the moving away from, you know, farmed, family farmed food and into processed food where we really started to go astray. And it's also that around the time that we start seeing a real uptick in chronic diseases. You know, so in the 50s and 60s, when the food industry sort of really began to create shelf-stable products, things that were in boxes, things that were in wrappers that would stay, you know, so-called fresh for long periods of time, there was a fair amount of food chemistry that allowed for these synthetic chemicals and changes in our oils that have been really detrimental to our health. So I think that's one part of it. Another part is, you know, the way that animals have been the way that animals have been raised has really been changed. We use a lot of antibiotics, hormones. We're not feeding them great food. They're eating corn for the most part to bulk up. And this is all, again, passed on to us when we consume meat. So those are two big ones. But there's also just a general moving away from the importance of food in our culture. Food is such an important way of sharing and expressing our culture and expressing our faith and being together with people. And, you know, lifestyles have become very busy and people are often eating out or eating alone or eating on the go. And that's been detrimental to our health as well.
Why do you think that makes a difference? The how, and as opposed to not just what we're eating, but how we're eating?
That's something we're actually going to talk about at the symposium. We're spending a good amount of time speaking around mindful eating and mindfulness during eating and the mind-gut connection, which is there's a lot of very powerful research showing how our emotions affect our gut and how our gut affects our emotions. But the simple act of sitting and eating and chewing and tasting and being mindful in that process actually improves digestion, improves mental health, and generally creates a better sense of well-being than eating on the run. And we have research around this. So, you know, these seem like very common sense sort of aspects of daily life, but we have to go back to the basics to really remember what food and eating really are about. It's not just around nutrition. It's also around a time of self-care and a time of togetherness and a time of rest.
You mentioned the gut and the whole idea of going back to our roots. There's also, I think, such interesting new research about our gut and our microbiome. How much of what we are consuming is important, not maybe necessarily for our body's nutrition, but for the good bacteria that lives inside of us?
It's pretty fascinating when you start learning about the microbiome, and I'll be speaking about this in some detail, but we have more bacterial DNA in our body than we have human DNA. We have a vast, vast population of trillions of organisms living in our gut, as well as in our mouth, as well as in other mucosal surfaces. And this microbiome is a living organ, truly. So research is showing that disruptions of this microbiome that can come from poor nutrition, from stress, from antibiotic use and overuse can have profound effects on our health, but specifically around our gut health. So the kind of food you eat can actually affect the populations of microbiota or bacteria that live in your gut. And one thing we'll be covering at the symposium is the use of fermented foods. We have a chef coming doing a wonderful fermentation demo of sauerkraut to show us that foods that are fermented actually can help keep our gut bacteria growing in a healthy manner.
My guest is Dr. Geetha Maker-Clark. She's talking about a Food as Medicine symposium that's going to be happening at the Chicago Botanic Gardens this weekend, this Sunday. It's actually sold out, so we have her here giving us some advice now on the line from Evanston. So when we talk about fermented foods and our gut bacteria, what kind of things are you thinking about in particular are good fermented foods that are healthy things that we should be thinking about eating more?
Many ancient wisdom cultures, probably every person, if they trace back to their grandmothers, can remember some kind of fermented food in their ethnic diets. So I'm talking about kimchi and sauerkraut and kefir. These are all very delicious and flavorful and well-known fermented foods. Miso is used very widely throughout East Asia. It's another fermented food. This is not a recipe for all people. I would say that if you have significant digestive disturbances, fermented food can actually make them worse. But as a general rule, if you have a healthy digestive system, eating fermented foods can really help keep your microbiome healthy.
And what about when we think about kids and helping raise, and I'm thinking in particular, I know a lot of your research is you're a family medicine practitioner. You like to treat families, everything from the mom while she's pregnant to through the lifespan of both that mother and child. What do you think is, let's start with children first before we get to moms and particularly during pregnancy, what do you think is really important or good habits to cultivate for young kids in terms of fermented foods, healthy foods?
Yeah, so children typically start to take in solid foods as young as 6 to 8 months old. And these are wonderful opportunities to start introducing children to more savory tasting foods. I think we have a predilection to go towards sweeter tasting foods early in life, and this can actually develop a palate that tends to prefer sweeter foods that can become more challenging as a baby moves into toddlerhood. So I usually will recommend pureed vegetables over fruits as baby foods and those first solid foods. And then moving into toddlerhood, keeping that sort of vegetable-based focus as a snack food. Fermented foods can be a challenge to give to young children because they are quite sharp and they can have a really strong flavor. But keeping them on, you know, predominantly vegetables along with their proteins as a younger child at least can set the stage for healthier eating habits as they get older. And some children don't mind the sharper tastes, in which case I think pickles are always a nice option for young children. I'm glad that you mentioned moms and pregnant moms in particular, because I really start helping children create healthy gut microbiomes before they're even born by making sure women of childbearing age are taking great care of themselves and their gut, because that microbiome that you are born with is seeded from your mother, truly. So that initial set of bacteria is coming from the mother's gut. So maternal health is even more important when it comes to the gut microbiome than what we do with the young child's diet.
You mentioned young children and fermented foods being tough, but I was just thinking about yogurt and the amount of kids that eat things like Go-Gurt. What are your thoughts about Go-Gurt and those sorts of, because everyone thinks, oh, yogurt's so healthy.
Yeah, and yogurt is really healthy, and I think it is a great thing to bring into a child's diet. However, I feel that the vast majority of yogurts that are geared towards children on the market are absolutely loaded with sugar. We're talking like 6-7 tablespoons of sugar per cup of yogurt. So far more than you'd ever give a child in any other type of food if you were giving them. So I think there's a way in which yogurt is sort of perceived as a healthy food, but then the way we're giving it to kids is almost like a junk food. There's also the piece of it being a dairy food, and that's not always something that all children can tolerate, especially kids who have upper respiratory conditions, who have asthma that might be exacerbated by dairy foods. So it's not a blanket food I would recommend to everyone, but I do think plain, full-fat yogurt is a wonderful thing to be able to get some good, healthy bacteria into a child when they're young. And you can even flavor it yourself with some fruit or a little bit of fruit juice or a bit of honey or agave nectar. That will definitively be less sugar than what's in the processed yogurts available on the market.
And what about dairy and the connection between dairy and, for example, allergies, you were saying, upper respiratory? What are we seeing with that when we're talking about kids and dairy?
Yeah, so we are not designed as humans to digest cow's milk very well beyond a certain age. It does require an enzyme called lactase that some of us genetically are just deficient in, and most of us become deficient in as we get older. So young children tend to be okay with cow's milk to a certain age, and then can potentially start to have some gastrointestinal irritation from it, sometimes stomach aches. Sometimes it manifests in other ways. There is some research that shows that dairy can exacerbate atopic conditions in particular, and those atopic conditions are conditions like allergies and eczema and asthma. So in that particular population of children, I'll recommend a dairy elimination to see if their symptoms improve.
And just to back to your point about moms and women of childbearing age and the importance of passing on a healthy gut, particularly for women, can you give us any advice on that?
You know, taking great care of oneself, especially when you're considering getting pregnant, is extraordinarily important, not just for your own health during pregnancy, but keeping in mind that your health in some way does determine the health of your newborn. And the more that we learn about the gut microbiome, you know, we kind of assumed that babies were born with a completely sterile, what we call sterile, meaning no bacteria in their gut, until the time that they pass through the mother's birth canal. However, we're actually seeing that there is a connection between the gut microbiome of the mother and a seeding of a initial set of microbiota that is being seeded into the infant gut even before birth. So this is a pretty tremendous paradigm shift, realizing that a mother potentially, for instance, taking antibiotics or not eating very well during her pregnancy could have an altered gut microbiome that is then passed to her infant. So what I would just recommend for pregnant moms is to be mindful of what she's eating, to really try to stay focused on a plant-based diet, to avoid processed foods, to avoid a lot of sugars, to eat fermented foods as they're tolerated, and to avoid being on antibiotics if possible. You know, of course, antibiotics exist for a reason. There is a time and a place for them, and they just need to be used judiciously.
Dr. Maker-Clark, are you think there are areas where we inflate the connection between food and health? Are there benefits we shouldn't expect from, or are there things that we maybe put too much emphasis on when we think about eating as opposed to the health connection?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that I would never suggest that food is the only medicine. Okay, I think that there is the power of using food as a medicine lies in its ability to work with everything else that you're doing in your life. So having a great diet is not going to make up for not getting enough sleep consistently and being exhausted and stressed. You can eat, you know, as well as you could ever imagine eating and not be getting sleep and being very stressed and still never attain great health and maybe even have really, you know, have your chronic diseases progress. So sleep, stress, exercise, these are just as important to me as food. And of course, I am a conventionally trained medical doctor. I believe very strongly in our healthcare system's ability to provide pharmaceuticals that can help people live happy, long lives when needed. I just don't advocate that that's the very first place that we go.
I want to thank Dr. Geetha Megha-Clark for being with us. As she mentioned, she practices integrative family medicine at North Shore University Health System. She's also the coordinator of integrative medical education for the Pritzker School of Medicine at the University of Chicago. Dr. Megha-Clark, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Just you wait.
Alexander Hamilton.
You
are waiting in the wings for you.
Waiting in the wings.
You can never back down. You never learn to take your time. Oh, Alexander Hamilton.
It's been nearly 3 years since Hamilton, the musical, first opened on Broadway. And since then, it's spread to the UK, but of course we remember that Chicago was the first city that Hamilton expanded to outside of New York. But the interest hasn't waned, and now Chicago is getting its own exclusive exhibition opening on Northerly Island this fall. Hamilton, the exhibition, is being billed as a one-of-a-kind interactive look at the story of America's founding, all told from this perspective of Alexander Hamilton. Chris Jones is a theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. He reported on this for the paper and joins us now. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the 21st.
How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yes. So, Hamilton, the exhibition. Because who could have predicted that Hamilton is still, maybe not as incredibly popular as it was, but certainly it hasn't really waned that much interest in the musical or even now Alexander Hamilton.
Well, one of the reasons it's not weighing that much is that they're very, very good at keeping it in everybody's, keeping attention on the show, whether it's sort of dropping new recordings or, you know, mixtapes or, in this case, an exhibition. So, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda has just been incredibly adept at, you know, rather than writing a new show, he's just continued to sort of, I guess you'd say promote, but also to just kind of extend the brand of Hamilton itself.
And there has really been, and you talked to him about this, I think he's surprised at the level of interest that people have in the actual historical person of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, whenever people ask me, why is this show the way it is? You know, why is there this level of demand? What the heck, you know? And it is an enormous level of demand, as you say. And I think in part it's because it's a substantial piece of art. And what I mean by that is it's not even Harry Potter or Frozen. It's about America. It's about the founding of the nation. It has a historical importance, and people see it as crucial, particularly for young people, for education. So he's been able to get people all the way up to President Obama, of course, and the First Lady, effectively promoting the show for him. And so I think this is in some ways an acknowledgement of that and an attempt to kind of create, a new experience for Hamilton fans. And essentially, from what I can understand, and I've seen renderings of pretty much of everything that they're going to do, so the deal is there's a tent-like structure, whether it's a tent might not be quite the right word, a temporary structure anyway, that's going to be on Northerly Island in Chicago, which is right out in the lake. Now, it doesn't open till November, so it's going to be really cold if you go out there in the first several weeks. So that's interesting, but that's a whole other issue. And then you're going to go there, you're going to pay your $35 or thereabouts, and you're going to walk through a kind of interactive exhibit, really all about Hamilton, the man, Alexander, that is, and all about the founding of this nation. And the thing that will make it different, of course, and the reason everybody will go, is that Lin-Manuel Miranda, maybe in hologram form or verbal form, will be your guide. And the exhibit obviously has access to the show. So, for example, the songs will be playing as part of your tour. The lyrics will be on the walls of the exhibit. So what they're going to be able to do that no other museum has really been able to do is integrate, sort of an exhibition on American history with the biggest hit show of the, last 100 years. So that's basically what's going on.
And Chris, to your point, Hamilton the Musical is a work of art. How much of this exhibition is about then the actual history, the actual facts of Alexander Hamilton's life?
Well, I think the exhibition is entirely about the facts of Alexander Hamilton's life. However, it is presented through a theatrical lens. So when they explained it all to me, there's a lot of very interesting kind of theatrical things you're going to be able to do. There's going to be a recreation of the room where it happened. There's going to be they're going to give people a sense of what happened when Hamilton moved uptown. After the death of his kid, there's a famous song in the musical where he goes uptown. It's Quiet Uptown, if you remember that song. And that, of course, back in the day, that was a trek into the, even though they were moving to essentially Upper Manhattan, it was a trek to into the rural world, if you like. So they're going to recreate that. There's going to be an ability to talk about what kind of presidency America should have now as it did then. So it's very much about the guy. I don't think that there's nothing in the exhibit on like how they made the show, or it's not like that. It's not a backstory to Hamilton the show. But it's all done by theater people. So it's going to be very immersive. And it's also very expensive. Like, I think they're spending, they wouldn't say exactly, but I think probably $10-15 million on this exhibit. So, I mean, it's not going to be, knocking around in a tent with a few display cases, if you know what I mean. It's going to be a lot more than that.
And I'm just thinking about the young people, and I'm thinking in particular of my nieces and nephews. My 6-year-old niece can do the entire Skylar Sisters rap. So I think that they're for children, and I'm thinking about children who love Hamilton, the musical. It sounds like a really interesting opportunity to present history in a way that hasn't been done before. And I suppose if someone could do that here, it would be Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think anything like this has ever quite been done in the same way, because most artworks or most shows, for example, are not, you can't really have Frozen the exhibition, right? You could have an exhibition on how they made it, but they're not. There's not anything there at the end of the day, whereas with Hamilton, you actually have, it's a bio musical, so you actually have this very important guy who is there really at the founding of American democracy. And the show has been highly successful in part because, it's emphasized the fact that he was an immigrant. And, of course, it uses a very diverse cast. So you have the sense that this history is for everybody, and that the founding of America is an issue that everybody, should be involved in. And so I think it really will, you know, have an enormous impact educationally. I mean, there is this question about how many people will go. Now, it's $35, which is more than it costs you to get in the Field Museum here, more than it costs you to get in the Met, I think. But it's still a lot less than going to the show, obviously.
And I did want to ask you about that cost. And I think particularly we know that musicals like Hamilton aren't affordable for a lot of people, although Lin-Manuel Miranda has really tried to get especially kids and public school students in front of this show. Do you think that that's also going to be a part of a component of this exhibition, is having school children there? Have you? I don't know if you've talked to him about that.
Yeah, I mean, they said essentially their aim is to have school groups come in for free. So I think, you know, if you're, I think almost all the Chicago public schools will go. I'm sure a lot of the suburban schools will go. I suspect some of the downstate schools will go too. So I think a lot of people will get to see it for free as part of a school group. Now, if you go with your kids, then you probably are going to pay, I'm guessing, about $20 or $25 for the kids, you know, alongside your $35. So, I, you know, they have had a very – they've had a kind of Robin Hood policy at Hamilton where they've charged as much as they possibly can for the really good seats, and then they've given away some seats. But, you know, let's not fool ourselves. For most people, it's a major investment. Now, I do think, you know, if we've been having this conversation a year ago – it was very expensive in Chicago, and I think now you can actually, particularly on a weeknight, particularly when the kids are not out of school, you actually can see Hamilton now for a lot less than you could a year ago, a lot less. And you know, and I think, you know, particularly if you buy fairly late in the game, there's often a few seats available if you're go on a Tuesday night or Wednesday night where you're not paying an enormous amount of money. So it's not as insane as it was in Chicago because, of course, it's been here for a while now. And the show is every bit as good. It's the same guy playing Hamilton as when it opened. But it's still, I sometimes feel now that people think it's a bit worse than it is, if you know what I'm saying. And you can actually get to see it. It's cheaper here, in fact, way cheaper than it is in Washington, where it's just now landing and the prices there are insane.
Or London. London's I mean, the prices in London are insane, too.
Insane, that's right.
Why Chicago for this exhibition? I mean, Hamilton is, in many ways, it's a New York story. It's a Washington story. Why is he opening this exhibition here?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think number one is that the show has, other than New York, the show has been here the longest. So that gives you, I think I calculated 1.5 to 1.7 million people have seen Hamilton in Chicago as we have this conversation right now. So that immediately is people who know the show. I would imagine a good percentage of those people would like to have another experience. So that gives them, you know, an audience that they can count on that they wouldn't have in a city that's not been exposed to the show. So that's number one reason. Number two is that you can't do this in New York because there's no space. So you can't, there's nowhere in Manhattan, to be honest, that you could do this because they want to stay. I think their hope in Chicago is they'd be here for 9 months, maybe a year. And they want to stay, and you can't, you know, you can't do this in Central Park. So the only place you can really do it in New York is New Jersey, and they didn't want to go to New Jersey. So I think Chicago has the benefit of the space that allows them to do it. Because even the Cirque du Soleil really struggled to find a spot to put their tent in Manhattan. The land is just so expensive there. So Chicago, I think, made sense for that reason.
And I imagine, like the musical itself in Chicago, he's expecting a lot of visitors from outside Chicago to attend this exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, the show has been a major tourist draw, major. I mean, people come from all over the place. Now, that will dissipate a little bit because there's more road tours going out of Hamilton, particularly beginning in the fall. So at that point, there's going to be... you know, you're going to be able to see it in Wisconsin, for example, which you haven't been able to up till now. And the more productions there are, I think that does reduce demand in Chicago if people can see it, you know, in St. Louis, say, or around, you know, the people will have other choices. But, you know, it still remains the majority of people there are from out of town. And I think the exhibition will be a huge draw. I mean, it's starting right before Thanksgiving, so I would imagine it will be really crammed. all the way through the end of the holidays. And then, you know, all the businesses in Chicago are pleased because tourism is really light in those cold months, you know, January, February, March. So to have a big new attraction like that is really good news for everybody. So there's a lot of people are like, great, we're going to have more people staying in the hotels and all of that. Now, whether this will really work out, you know, are people going to drive 5 and 6 hours to see what's basically a historical exhibit? And there's no actual artifacts either. You know, that's worth thinking about. There's no, you don't get to see any of his actual stuff. It's all just clever, you know,
holograms of Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Exactly. But, you know, in my experience, I got to say, anyone who's bet against Hamilton so far has been wrong. It just has an enormous level of pre-awareness. And it's just, someone said to me a week ago or so, if anyone else was trying to do this on Northerly Island in the winter, they would fail because it's cold out there. It's icy. You know, I'm not quite clear where people are going to park. There's a lot of, you look at it, you go, really? That's not going to be easy. But it's Hamilton, people are just willing to do anything for Hamilton, it seems.
Chris, one last question for you. Yeah. Is there an alternative for people who are thinking, okay, so that's the Hamilton, the exhibition, opening in November. So we're getting people excited a little in advance. But
yeah,
for folks who are planning to come to Chicago, you know, we have people tuning in all over the state, and there are people who are coming to Chicago for shows this summer, and Hamilton is just too expensive, especially if we're thinking about a family. What are the alternatives to great theater in Chicago this summer?
Well, there's a lot of interesting shows. One of the things that we have in Chicago a lot of is pre-Broadway shows. That is to say, shows that, you know, start in Chicago and then eventually make their way to New York. And one of those that we have coming up actually is the Cher show, which is a new. A brand new musical that is really dedicated to the life and times of Cher, and that's playing pretty much most of June and July. Another Broadway show that's going to be here is The Tour of Waitress, which I like very much. And I like The Color Purple, which is another really, really great sort of Broadway musical as well. So those are three other downtown shows that people can see. There's also an interesting new production sort of based around Elvis called Heartbreak Hotel that was done. It's opening in July here, and it's the work of people who did the Million Dollar Quartet show. So there's that. And then you've got Stacey Keach coming back to the Goodman Theatre for Pampola, which will be exciting, I think. And then, of course, you've got a variety of plays like Steppenwolf. There's a whole bunch of things there this summer. So, you know, we have a lot of theatre in town. You can fill a weekend. You can fill a week if you wanted to.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. We'll have to have you come back for a whole other segment about other theater apart from musicals and apart from Hamilton in
Sounds
Chicago
good.
This summer. Chris Jones is the Chicago Tribune's theater critic. Chris, thanks for being with me. I appreciate
it. My pleasure.
And no one else is in the room where it happened.
Alexander Hamilton.
What did they say to you to get you to sell New York City down the river?
Alexander Hamilton.
Did Washington know about the dinner? Was there presidential pressure to deliver?
Doesn't matter where you put the U.S. capital.
Cause we'll have the banks, we're in the same spot.
You got more than you gave.
And I wanted what I got. When you got skin in the game, you stay in the game. But you don't get a win unless you play in the game. Oh, you get love for it, you get hate for it. You get nothing if you
wait for it, wait for it, wait.
God help and forgive me. I wanna build something that's gonna outlive me.
What do you want, girl? What do you want, girl? If you stand for nothing, girl,
be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens. I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
I wanna be in the room where it happens.
I wanna be in the room where it happens.
Saying what they trade away.
We trade away.
dream of a brand new start.
But we dream in the dark for the most part.
Dark as a tune where it happens.
I've got to be in the room
where it happens.
I've got to be
in the room where it happens.
I've got to be
in the room where it happens.
I've got to be in the
room where it happens.
I gotta be
in the room where it happens. I wanna be in the room where it happens.
Click, boom.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the past several months, high school students have been organizing marches and pushing for change in their communities, especially since the Parkland shooting back in February. We've heard teenagers across the country been the voice demanding change. Many of those students calling for change aren't old enough to vote. Vote 16 Illinois is one organization that's hoping to change that. It started back in 2016, and their goal is to lower the voting age to 16, which would allow teenagers to vote in municipal elections. Back in the fall of 2016, as a high school senior, Carly Hansen and another student at Northside College Prep in Chicago co-founded the Illinois chapter of Vote 16. Today, Carly's a rising sophomore at Bryn Mawr, a double major in poli-sci and biology. She's back home in Chicago, and she's on the line with me now to tell us more about Vote 16. Hi, Carly. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Carly, so I talked a little bit about the goals of Vote 16, but what are you hoping to accomplish with the organization?
So what we want to do is by extending the municipal voting right to 16 and 17-year-olds, we hope to instill habitual voting in young voters. And basically what that means is that there's empirical evidence that shows once someone votes for the first time, they're more likely to vote in subsequent elections. And so we believe, and many others believe, that lowering the voting age to 16 in municipal elections would allow for 16 and 17-year-olds to not only vote on issues critical to their neighborhoods and communities, but also to get them ready for a lifelong voting experience.
And to be clear, this is something where you would just like voting to happen in municipal elections.
Yeah, so this would be for local offices such as school boards, city councils, or even the mayor of their town.
And is this based on how other countries do this, right? 16-year-olds can vote in places like Argentina and Austria or Scotland. Is that where you guys were getting the inspiration for this from?
So we definitely draw some inspiration from those countries, but there are also cities in the United States that have actually implemented this. In Tacoma Park in Hyattsville, Maryland, 16 and 17-year-olds have been able to vote since 2014. And in the elections that have followed since then, 16 and 17-year-old turnout, or the turnout of the 16 and 17-year-olds that voted for the first time in 2014 hasn't dropped. And turnout rates of young voters are actually four times higher than in other places around the country where the 16 and 17-year-old voting isn't implemented. So there is empirical evidence that shows that these voters are continuing to turn out.
And Carly, I understand that your focus is on the empirical evidence of voting and changing voting behavior, but I'm curious what your thoughts are when you look at the activism that we've seen among young people in this country, especially since the Parkland shooting in February. How has it been for you to watch as a 18-year-old watching all of that happen now?
So I got to vote in my first election in March, which was super thrilling. It was vote by mail, so arguably not as exciting as actually going to the voting booth, but a lot of our inspiration for continuing Vote 16, even as 18 and 19-year-olds, we do have some college students within the Vote 16 Illinois organization still who are continuing to help out. But it's been really inspiring seeing the 16 and 17-year-olds and even younger people showing up in other ways that aren't voting and demonstrating that they are involved in their communities and they are interested and engaged in politics and they want to continue this activism. And we believe that giving them the right to vote at 16 and 17 in municipal elections where they're voting on candidates and for offices that impact them very directly, we believe that empowers them even further and encourages them to not only vote, but just be involved in politics in general for the rest of their lives.
Carly, I imagine the pushback you get from this is that this is expensive to implement, and it's probably something expensive to implement, and there may not be high voter turnout. What's your response to that?
Well, I'd just say that 16 and 17-year-olds are contributing to their economies in their municipalities and in their states. 16 and 17-year-olds work. They pay sales tax, and some 16 and 17-year-olds are even tried as adults. So we believe that the voting rights should be extended to 16 and 17-year-olds because they are active participants in these areas. And also a lot of pushback we get from people is that people, it's not even about the that this would be expensive to implement, because this would only require a charter change in cities that are charter cities and that are under home rule. So this wouldn't be expensive to implement, but a lot of pushback is that people think that 16 and 17-year-olds aren't engaged in their communities, and I think the recent wave of activism, especially following the Parkland shooting, has been evidence that 16 and 17-year-olds are, in fact, really involved in their communities.
And do you have a sense that that's maybe emboldened your movement of Vote 16? I'm thinking in particular in Illinois, what would you like to see happen?
Absolutely. So in the fall, we're actually planning on drafting a resolution with Alderman Harry Osterman to be introduced in the Chicago City Council. So our focus right now is on non-binding resolutions in order to show the Illinois General Assembly that cities are ready and excited to implement this change. So that's our main area of focus going forward. And also the fact that this has been in national news, the idea of lowering the voting age to 16 has really given us in Illinois some attention as well. And we're looking forward to continuing to use that momentum working forward.
That's Carly Hansen. She's co-founder of Vote 16 in Illinois, currently a rising sophomore at Bryn Mawr, studying political science and biology. We caught up with her now that she's back in Illinois over summer break. Carly, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you again so much for speaking with us.
Last month, police in Madagascar made a shocking discovery. They were sent to investigate bad smells coming from an abandoned two-story house, and what they found was more than 10,000 critically endangered tortoises living in horrific conditions. Several hundred of the tortoises were already dead or dying due to the conditions when police arrived. According to reports, the tortoises covered nearly every inch of the dirt-covered floor and had no access to food or water. Over the past few decades, the population of this particular species of tortoise, the radiated tortoise, has declined by 80% at the hands of illegal wildlife traffickers. Why are we talking about this on the 21st? Well, that's because an Illinois vet was part of the team that helped to rescue and treat these tortoises, and he's actually just returned from Madagascar. He's on the line from Chicago. Dr. Matt O'Connor is a U of I alum as well as a vet at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. Dr. Matt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Matt, I was looking at the pictures of this house, and it's just really heartbreaking when you look at the pictures of all of these poor tortoises. How did you first learn about this?
Yeah, so luckily with the power of the internet and, you know, being connected to other folks who have a particular interest in turtles and tortoises, I saw the initial sort of release of the discovery of over 11,000 tortoises initially. And as you mentioned, they're in such bad conditions that over 1,000 quickly died within the first few days of finding them. And so I reached out to some of my friends in the Turtle Survival Alliance just to gauge if they needed assistance to go over to Madagascar and help take care of some of those tortoises, which they promptly replied they did. So I was part of the second wave of volunteers who went over there to help treat and nurse some of those tortoises back to full health.
What was the situation like when you got to Madagascar, Dr. Matt?
Luckily, by the time I got there with the second wave, one of the kind of amazing things with reptiles in general is they're very hardy creatures, which is one of the reasons they're unfortunately targeted for the legal pet trade. You know, if you catch a bird or something, try and ship it to another country, chances are it's going to get stressed out and succumb to disease within a few days, whereas tortoises can survive sometimes months in terrible conditions. But if you're able to find them and get them into a better situation with proper husbandry, you know, exposure to natural sunlight, a good diet, they can bounce back pretty well. So luckily, a lot of the tortoises bounced back fairly well once we were able to provide them proper housing. But we still would find about maybe 100 or so a day that needed medical treatment. As some of those got healthy, sometimes other ones would pop up being sick in the larger group. So although most of the tortoises were turned out to be healthy, which was great, there were a lot that we needed to just medically treat and get weight back on them because they hadn't eaten anything in so long.
Mm. What was your day like there, Dr. Matt? Were you just treating sick turtles all day?
Yeah, so typically they split. The volunteers came from all walks of life in the kind of the zoo and aquarium world. We had veterinarians, veterinary technicians, we had keepers, we had curators, which is more like a managerial level at a zoo or aquarium. And so we kind of split up into two different teams. We had our medical team and then our husbandry team that would go out and take care of the turtles in the pens, feed them, change water, see if anyone was acting sick, and then they bring them to the hospital. So for the team I was on, we typically get there early in the morning. Luckily, there's, you know, so many tortoises. A lot of the treatments that we're using were once every 3 days. So that allowed us to make the numbers a little bit more manageable. So every day we had a certain group of tortoises that were marked that would come up to the hospital for evaluation. If they were deemed healthy enough to be released back in the general population, we would do that. Other ones would keep getting treated. And then we had the sickest group that would be in the hospital. So typically we would finish treating, we would treat those ones last just because we didn't want to expose anyone else to potentially what we might be seeing. When you go somewhere like Madagascar and are dealing with this many animals, it's more of a triage situation. So we don't always have those answers and the blood work results and things that you typically have in a veterinary hospital to kind of guide treatment. So we're using our best guess and our experiences working with these species to determine what to treat them with. But typically we would finish treating those hospitalized cases by about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at that point, unfortunately, there would be some that would die. By the time I got there, the numbers had got down from an average of like 10 a day to maybe anywhere from 2 to 6. So again, that was a good sign that we were kind of getting ahead of things and successfully treating them. But in veterinary medicine, we try to make the most of a bad situation. So even those ones that had died, we would do a necropsy, which is basically like an animal autopsy, just to try and determine what they died of in, you know, parasites, were they too thin, to help guide treatment for the ones that were still alive.
Mm. What can you tell us about this particular species?
Yeah, so this particular species, as you mentioned, has seen a precipitous decline in their population. They used to be almost compared to the American bison, to where they were so plentiful in parts of southern Madagascar that you could literally see them on the sides of the road. But due to collection for the legal pet trade because of their beautiful shell, as the name radiated tortoise kind of implies, and also areas further north, the adult tortoises have been collected to become part of the bushmeat trade. Their populations have really declined, but typically they're found in the south of Madagascar in these kind of dry thorn scrub desert forests. And they will kind of eat a lot of dry material, cactuses, things of that nature. They live a long time, like most tortoises and turtles.
How long?
So they actually don't reach sexual maturity until they're about 20 years old. And there was one on record that lived 150 years.
Wow. So Dr. Matt, what do you want folks in Illinois to do? Is there any way people can get involved? What can we do to help or know more about this situation?
Yeah, so this is a great example of kind of the modern day aquarium and zoo, where we do a lot of work, not only within the doors at Shedd Aquarium, but outside those. And people in Illinois can help out in several different ways. So the people that have gone over there, we're also going to be sending a veterinary technician, Rachel Parcham, soon. And we are both a part of what's known as the Shedd Aquarium Animal Response Team. So people in Illinois can go to the Shedd Aquarium website and donate money to help support these efforts going over to Madagascar to take care of these tortoises. Also, more locally, we have something that's called GLAAD, which is Great Lakes Action Days, and that's anyone can volunteer to help kind of clean up beaches, restore native environments for amphibians and fish in the Chicagoland area.
Well, we'll have more information about that at our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Dr. Matt for being with us. As he said, his work as a vet at the Shedd Aquarium, he just got back from Madagascar dealing with this situation there. Dr. Matt, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. It was great talking with you today.
That does it for us today and for this week. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.